I mix what I like.
All right, this is Dr. Hate with WPFW 89.3 FM on a day-long programming set called Ferguson and Beyond. And we have with us live in the studio Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs, Bill Wax from Roots and Fruits, and Dr. JB on the way, my mix what I like. And online we now have with us Brother Kali Akuno of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. And we want to get straight into this report on Operation Ghetto Storm and just supplement that with this idea of the ProPublica report that examined federal data of fatal police shootings from 2010 to 2012. And this report stated that young black men are 21 times more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. Right, so blacks age 15 to 19 were killed at a rate of 31.17 per million, while whites are 1.47 per million in that age range of 15 to 19, dying at the hands of police between 2010 and 2012. Brother Kali Akuno, you have this report with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and tell us about those numbers, the tagline numbers that are happening right now in the media that really don't reference the report. I think Dr. Ball was talking about that a number of times with you on the air in my mix, what I'm like. But 2012, what are the numbers of black folks killed by extrajudicial murders?
Pleasure to be here. First thing I think we always have to note is that we do not know the full number. What our research did was pulled together what we could find through various ways of searching the public record. And a lot of the information of 313 that we tabulated in 2012 actually was not reported in a lot of the federal reports that are being cited now. So that's one thing to keep in mind. There is no federal agency which is actually gathering all of this data. And there are a few state entities which are actually gathering this data. And then where there are a few states that seem, you know, per our research, where there are a few states that are gathering this information, several of them do not disaggregate the information by race, and that's often intentional. So you really have to do some deep kind of investigation to gather, I think, all of the information to get a clear perspective and a clear picture of what's happening to our community and what's happening particularly to a lot of the young black men and women between that age gap to get a clear sense of what's going on. But one of the kind of things that muddies the waters, if you would, again, is there is no mandate to gather this information. And where there are mandates, particularly since the 1980, it's about making sure that it's intentionally muddy as it regards to race, so that many of the, particularly the Republican forces who really push that hard, but they weren't alone, so they can kind of tout this myth that there's progress, that there's change, but at the same time, you know, we have to look at the war on drugs and a lot of the kind of corresponding policies and who they're targeting and how they increase the numbers around mass incarceration, I think, to really uncover the extent to which these extrajudicial killings are happening and what are the source around this aggressive policing and containment policies that are being put forth by various agencies of the government.
And Dr. Kuno, this is Todd Stephen Burroughs. It's great to talk to you. I wanted to ask about when this report came out, this Malcolm X Grassroots report came out. Did the mainstream media pick it up? Were you, in effect, believed? Or was this kind of under the table? Because with all of the YouTube videos and cell phone videos right now, you know, I guess the stat could be more easily believed by people who would be skeptical initially. But what happened when the report first came out?
When it first came out, there was a great deal of silence, save for the progressive media. And I should know progressive black media. If you want to say, caught a break with some of the earlier reports. So we actually did three reports in the span of a year that led up to the every 28 hours analysis, right? But the first piece that we looked at early in the year was every 36 hours. And as the year progressed, it became every 28 hours. the initially in some of the early demonstrations regarding Trayvon Martin's case, the mainstream media picked up at least the hashtag line, the often quoted line from Jesse Jackson citing the figures. And to a lesser extent, some of the mainstream media has picked up on it from the Minister Louis Farrakhan citing those numbers. And that was in, I think, my member served correctly in May of 2012. Then we did the next series of kind of analysis and reports that came out later in the summer. And Davey D, you know, hip-hop commentary and journalist, who's a good friend and ally of many of us, he did a coverage report, and that really kind of gave it broader exposure. But to directly answer your question, for the most part, we did a lot of outreach to the mainstream media. And it was, we got some interviews with a couple of outlets in terms of folks calling us on the phone, asking us for how we compiled the data and the information which we sent. But nothing really came out of that. And at the end of the day in 2013, when the final report came out, it did get a small amount of coverage on Democracy Now!, and it did get reference in several articles in the Huffington Post. But that's as mainstream as it got, if you would, in terms of getting out for the mainstream media. But trust me, given all the media work and the media team that we had working on it then and working on it now, many of the folks who have access and entree and know people personally on the CNNs and the MSNBCs, et cetera. But they have had a difficult time breaking through. And a lot of it, we've been told very directly, had to do with who we are and what our political beliefs are and what we were espousing as kind of the rationale and analysis within the report. And that was very stated very clearly to me by several folks who had interviewed me, who wanted, you know, journalists who wanted to break the story, who wanted to break the news, but this is what they had to report back to me in a friendly manner. This is what their editorial policies were dictating. This was the word from on high that this information was not going to get out or to see the light of day if they could help. So, you know, there's a political reason that a lot of the information was ignored, and I think that always has to be, you know, brought home. And still to this day, if I may, you know, even we've been very supportive of some of the things that have come out. Some of the FBI released some stuff themselves directly a few weeks ago. And then now this latest piece that you cited from ProPublica. So there's more information that's out there that's validating what we said. But it's still curious to us that some of these forces who we have reached out into, some of them have reached out to us, still do not, in their final published pieces, they still do not reference the work and reference the report. So there's still some of this kind of whitewashing, if you would, of the actual figures. But, you know, the good thing, I guess, in part about, you know, the current age that we live in is that social media has its own profound impact. And, you know, progressive media and the social movement have been picking up on it, and it's put it out there. So, it's not like it's unknown. It's just unreferenced.
You know, when I think about the conversation we just had with Brother Leonard Moore talking about police brutality in New Orleans, and he's referencing, you know, reports going out from 1800s. Mm-hmm. I think about your report and your Operation Ghetto Storm report in the context of We Charge Genocide, the documented lynchings within the U.S. And I'm struck by the graphs that I see coming out of those reports, because between 1882 and like 1960, the highest number of recorded lynchings is about 160. Right. And when we think of times getting better, we think of lynching being as the end all be all symbol of violence against African people within the U.S. But we don't look at it in the same way that we would now. Because we think, you know, those things stopped. So do you look at the police brutality of murder of black folks as a modern form of lynching? How do you see that? How do you make sense of the numbers and explain either progress or status quo to the African community?
And I think that's an important question, because when we deal with lynching versus the police, we deal with mob activity sanctioned by the police, but police brutality is actually sanctioned by the state. You know, so I would like to also you to talk about what you feel is the difference between the two.
Good questions. Good questions. We do see it and have seen it from the beginning as a modern form of lynching. And we were working very explicitly in the tradition of the Ida B. Wells and the William Pattersons and the folks who put out the We Charge Genocide. You know, that whole community had worked on that, being conscious of that as social movement activists and historians ourselves. And we, in part, were trying to utilize some of the same format to show a continuity of history and to teach a younger generation that this is a pervasive and systemic practice. It has a long history, and it's first and foremost reason is social control of us, of a largely unwanted population that was only brought here for our labor. And as the economy has shifted from agricultural-based chattel slavery to an industrial economy to now a post-industrial economy and a service-oriented economy, which increasingly does not need and does not desire black labor, we are being put more and more into a precarious situation and have been, I would argue, for several generations. You know, going back to the late 1960s, and some would argue in the early 1950s, when if you begin to look at some of the information that A. Philip Randolph and folks like that started to compile during the Korean War, which is often forgot about, around black unemployment being, you know, greater than white unemployment and other forms of unemployment, that there was a structural reason for that, and how automation and all these things, a lot of this analysis that we have put out. You know, if you really look at it, the foundations of it were laid in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So we have just been trying to bring it up to speed and current to say, okay, particularly since the 1980s, since, you know, the period of Reagan, where there was a very intentional effort to build the prison industry and to really make it a profitable industry. There's been a tremendous drive to incarcerate more of our people, in part to contain the social movement, but also to deal with the nature of the changing economy, knowing that there was not going to be viable, sustainable, high-wage employment to sustain particularly, you know, black families, working-class black families. So one of the solutions, if you would, that have been devised and been operating since the 1980s has been mass incarceration. Part of what we were subtly arguing for in the Operation Ghetto Storm, and more so in this companion, Let Your Model Be Resistant, is that, you know, part of this whole mass incarceration piece is probably peaked. You know, I'm not going to say it's regressing or declining or in reverse, but it's probably peaked. And what you hear, particularly in some of the Midwestern and the Southern states, and this was even before the crisis of 2007-2008, that it was becoming increasingly hard for those states to keep up those expenditures around the whole mass incarceration and containment complex. And there was this beginning to be a public conversation around alternatives. And the alternatives weren't that much better, or aren't that much better, but, you know, it was, let's take people out of the warehouses, let's take them out of the cages, and let's put ankle braces on them, let's do workforce development kind of things on them, but the monitoring, et cetera, increases. But what it would do was take them off the books of having to pay, you know, the wardens and the guards and the upkeep and the maintenance on these facilities. And it speaks to a deeper structural crisis that the entire United States is going in relative to kind of state expenditure. So the consequence, if you're not going to warehouse folks, but you still have no jobs, no employment, no decent housing for them to go to, you got to resort to other options. Myself, I was doing a great deal of work in Katrina in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast right after Katrina. And a lot of the kind of clear patterns of where it seems to be, you know, where the economic and social forces are pushing things, you know, they're trying to come up with some new solutions on what they're going to do with black folks in particular. And one of the things that I'm arguing for is that there are, you know, without the incarceration kind of parameters that are being limited and pushed back on, the trainings, if you just look at it that way, where the intentionality are, and the increased militarization since 2001 and the Anti-Patriot Act and what that kind of enabled, there's directly a much more promoted shoot first, ask questions later, which leads to, you know, these increasing numbers that we, like you noted, we haven't seen in any year during the height of what people think of as lynching. So we're arguing that there are, you know, you're not going to find in paper, not in this day and age, that, you know, let's exterminate the brutes, you know, quote unquote, type of, you know, smoking gun out there. But if you look at the pattern, if you look at the training, if you look at the orientation, and you look at how common it is, consistent it is from one state to another, clearly there's this, you know, message of repress and do whatever you can to repress. And you see it kind of coming to bear in these numbers. So there's an intentionality, which is still about containment. But I think they're searching for some new options. And in this period, the numbers, I think, have definitely risen, and I would argue continue to rise, even with going on what's taking place in Ferguson. We got to be mindful, you know, that after Mike Brown, there were two killings right in that surrounding community.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the pressure is on, they still have not fundamentally changed their orientation. They've bent a little bit, hoping that that would kind of calm folks down, but they haven't broke. They haven't given up ground yet. So, you know, we got to be vigilant. I think, you know, Ferguson and what's going on in St. Louis is one of the most profound things we've seen in quite some time. I mean, folks being able to maintain the pressure to the level they have for the past 70 plus days. We haven't had that level of continued resistance in quite some time, but we see that even with that, it's going to take a lot more, and they can't do it by themselves. We have to build a national movement that's really going to push back on folks in this regard.
Absolutely. You know, when you're talking about the solutions to this excess number of black folks within the U.S., I think, you know, when you started talking about incarceration wouldn't cut it because it's expensive for the state to carry out. One thing we've actually watched is people having to pay for their own trial and, you know, the exorbitant costs that you would find in anything related to the expenses of day-to-day life in prison, from phone calls to food to anything else. You know, what I'm imagining is going to happen, especially within this capitalist structure, is people who are incarcerated will be forced to pay for their incarceration themselves. And so anything that goes on within the prison system will actually be funded, and the funds generated for that support and maintenance of the system by the folks who are incarcerated. You know, and then we also see coming straight out of enslavement period to this debt and sharecropper modality of working.
That's right.
Where folks are essentially stuck on the very same plantations where they were enslaved continuously and can't get up off of them because of all of the debt that goes into their work. So, you know, they have to pay for their daily living expenses through their work, and their work doesn't actually give them enough money to actually pay for anything. So they're always in debt. And I think we can see that, you know, real simply with these ideas of, you know, the $1 trillion plus rising costs of the educational system and getting a college degree that's supposed to be the minimum standard now to anything else. So we see it in society in general that folks aren't getting jobs to actually pay off what was supposed to secure them a job. But for black folks, this excess population, it's like, one, you either use them as a military, as black folks have been the military for nearly every imperial army that we've seen throughout history for the past couple thousand years of empires. So that's one way to get the excess out, is just put them on the front lines and let them kill each other, right? But then the other piece is just, you know, if they're going to be enslaved, have them pay for their own enslavement. And it's, you know, it's a scary thing each time I think about that. Our taxes are the ones that are paying our murderers, right? So
that's right.
That's a serious problem, at least with the lynchings. You know, the cops got the hoods on them, and now the hoods are off, and we see what the cops look like, and the hoods got numbers on them, so the police just turn the badges around on them hoods, and they don't let you see them, so you can't report them. So, I mean, there's a number of different things that we're seeing from Ferguson and beyond, to tag that line, that's consistent with what you've reported in the Operation Ghetto Storm, and then, you know, this dystopic view of what the U.S. is going to look like for black folks. That'll actually be in a worse situation than we've ever been.
For many of us, we're already there. You know, there's just a lot of myths that we ourselves, to a certain extent, through some of the media, want to try to portray. But I think we're going to have to break that, and I think some of the recent struggles are working to break that. You know, so this bling bling kind of orientation, that entire fantasy, I think, is for many kind of coming to a close, and they're kind of just recognizing the reality.
What do you think about the recent victories in terms of Renisha McBride, her killer is going to jail, the Loud Music shooter, he's in jail for life? Do you see that as progress, or do you see that as part of the fantasy?
Part of the fantasy, but also see it as a different process. You know, both of those were quote unquote civilians. And even though our community responded, and rightly so, with the same type of fervor and reaction that we often see, you know, with police killings. You know, both of those were civilians, so they didn't have the FOP supporting them. They didn't have, you know, the other entities of the state supporting those particular actors. And in both of those cases, I mean, the evidence, I thought, was so clear cut and dry that even those who were defending them from the beginning of both of those cases, I think we looked at it, tried to make kind of clear concessions to what the prosecution was putting out. That's profoundly different than what happens when any of these police officers, other folks who are kind of appointed in one form or another by the state to use violence in some particular form, be they off-duty cops or, you know, folks who are deputized to do community sweeps and community patrols, like Zimmerman. There's a different level of engagement and a different level of protection that those forces have from the state that even white civilians, don't have to the same degree. Now, that doesn't mean that those two cases, I think, particularly the case, you know, with the young sister, I was actually shocked to the degree that he was sentenced myself, in trying to look and study that dynamic of what was there. Some of that, I think, has to do with the history of Detroit and the last vestiges of black political power that exist there, because there's been some precedent there going back to the late 50s and 1960s, particularly the 1960s, when, you know, there were a number of judges who protected some of the RNA and some of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers who had gotten the struggles with the police, and were able to deal with that and put the onus of proof and the burden on the state, which cleared folks of some of the things that the state was trying to perpetrate. So there's still, you know, even with the state takeover, there's still, I think, a certain level of pockets of that, residual pockets of that power up in that region, which is one of the reasons why they try to dismantle it and destroy what was going on in Detroit over the past several decades in the first place. So I think we got to look at it and make some of those clear distinctions of, you know, how quote-unquote civilian populations are treated from the military force.
So the issue is that if someone is literally an agent of the state, it's different from a civilian.
Well, that's actually, and Kali, what's up, man? It's Jared. I finally made it in, and thanks to everybody for holding it down and making this programming sound so good and work so well. But Kali, it's reminded me of what George Jackson used to say about, you know, someone who could pass the municipal exam could kill me legally tomorrow. Like, that's the only subtle difference here, you know. It's like, this is just an update of that. So I appreciate your point about the differences in the way that these killings are responded to when carried out by the state officially or quasi-officially, and when not, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's one case that just brought my attention where we still got to notice, you know, even though there's some distinctions I think we have to be mindful of, you know, there's a diversity of response from the state. So even in the St. Louis metropolitan area, you know, there's a case where there was a former policeman who robbed several banks and actually was caught in the act, shot back and actually shot a police officer who happened to have a bulletproof vest and got shot in the leg himself. But having shot a police officer, this gentleman, white gentleman, wound up only getting 18 years. Now, just think about what would have happened if someone who didn't have the complexion for the connection had done some of that, which brings us back to our political prisons. Many of who've been accused of shooting police over the years, and some, like in the case of Matulu, basically no evidence, but they are left to rot underneath the jail for just the very thought of promoting various forms of resistance to the state, as in the case again of Matulu. So, you know, we got to look at it, I think, in its complexity to be able to fully understand it and come up with a program of action and a concrete program of resistance, you know, to I think strategically go at the heart of the matter and to figure out, well, who are our allies, you know, where are they, to what extent are they, you know, how far are they going to walk the road with us, and where do they get on, where do they get off? You know, I think those are some of the things, you know, again, speaking in the context of what's going on in Ferguson and what we can all learn from it that I think we need to be mindful of.
All right, this is Dr. Haight. That was Kali Akuno of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. We want to thank you very much, brother. Please, to the audience, go out and download and read and disseminate the report, Operation Ghetto Storm. It's extremely important to read about the research that's happening within police brutality by independently organized black grassroots movements organizations. Please go out and find that.
I mix what I like.